I mean, any technology is a cycle and a pendulum. I'm a static website enthusiast. We're like the paramedics, and we've just got the defibrillator on Jamstack. We've just done the... And we're seeing if there's life there. And there is. Like, there are people who are really interested in Jamstack and want it to exist. What the movement is about is trying to figure out exactly what that is and what that circle and core values are.
Hey, this is Brian, and you're listening to Jamstack Radio, a bi-weekly series where we discuss modern web development with maintainers, founders, and developers. Jamstack Radio is brought to you by HeavyBit, the leading investor in developer-first startups. For more information, visit heavybit.com. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, or if you'd like to suggest a topic, find us on Twitter, at Jamstack Radio.
Welcome to the installment of Jamstack Radio. On the line, we got Mike from CloudClanon. Mike, actually, I failed to even ask how to pronounce your last name. So do you want to pronounce your last name and then tell us what you do?
My name is Mike Newmigan, and I'm a static website enthusiast. Co-founded a company called CloudClanon, and usually spend all day thinking and talking about static websites.
Yeah. And like CloudClanon is like earliest partner, the stuff that, so I joined Netlify pretty early. A lot of folks know this already. But yeah, CloudClanon has been around like since pre-Jamstack. So you've seen it all at this point. So actually, I want to ask you the question. What is Jamstack?
Flipped on me. Great question. It is something I'm spending a lot of time trying to figure out the answer to. I think it means a lot of things to a lot of different people. My feeling about it is rooted in kind of the initial definition of Jamstack, where it's about pre-rendering websites and using decoupled services. And just that simplicity and mindset of static, autonomic deploy, all the files just live on the server. It's just files, there's nothing dynamic running. I just really like that paradigm and that simplicity.
Yeah. And I think we're going through like a sort of a, like we had the Jamstack renaissance. And so Jamstack, the term, has kind of been a little bit more fluid in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And like we're seeing where the original intro to this podcast was like JavaScript APIs and markup.
Yeah.
And that was the jam. But then we lowercased everything and Jamstack became more of like a fluid term. Because at the time, like static sites, that was the focus. Like how could you get static sites deployed in like a very quick way? And also like promise uptime and security and a bunch of other stuff. But then we saw JavaScript evolve. So you've seen this evolution. And like I'm curious how this has affected CloudClanon and how y'all are focused on what you do.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to be a part of that story. Like when I first came to the Bay Area, there was a guy running a static web tech meetup, and it was Matt Billman, co-founder of Netlify. And in the room was me, Matt, Chris, another co-founder of Netlify, and I think one other person. And we were just talking about static sites and, you know, Jekyll was somewhat popular during the day, but it was still like this very niche community and way of thinking about building for the web. WordPress was dominating at the time. So seeing that evolution of static websites becoming more popular, Netlify played a huge role in that. And then hitting limitations and solving those limitations and to the point where we have pretty complex applications and it's sort of the way most new projects, the mainstream way web projects are built today is with this approach of Jamstack.
Yeah, it's wild to see that. I mean, I witnessed the evolution as well. And like even back in the day, like to tell people like, okay, well, what's your build tool? Like, how are you getting this to HTML? Like at the time, like I guess a lot of people weren't around on that time or like it was a blip in like their history.
Yeah.
But like, I remember distinctively, like when you publish a Heroku, a node application, like Heroku ran NPM start.
Yeah.
And he had a running server, like running whatever like was delivered to you by Express.js. And there was like a huge, like a shift that Netlify helped champion, which is like, instead of doing NPM start, NPM run build. And before that, it was basically like, Gulp, Grunt, Browserify. Like there were a bunch of other build tools that established this like playing field to like compete against a WordPress. So you don't have to like get like a full on LAMP stack server that you have to pay for compute per second or bandwidth. And like now the bar was like lowered for a bunch of engineers. But as you mentioned, we hit some limitations. And like, do you want to hit like share some limitations when it came to doing static only sites?
Yeah. So I feel like Jamstack was really a big move against WordPress in the early 2010s to 2015, maybe.
Yeah.
Because you have all this complexity with WordPress and this complicated ecosystem and all these plugins and moving parts that all have to fit together, which is powerful for a non-technical editor, but it's also fragile. All those plugins need to work together. They might have, any single one might have a security vulnerability. You need to keep them up to date. So Jamstack said, let's just get rid of all of that and go back to just handcrafting HTML and CSS and pre-rendering it and go back to static files and just avoiding all that complexity. So Cloud Cannon actually just started off with purely static websites. And the way it worked is you would put static files in Dropbox. We didn't have Git support at the time. It would sync it to a web server and then it would just be a live website. And then you could add a class of editable to any element. And then a non-technical person could update that content directly on the page. There was a lot of freelance developers who were really into that. But the first limitation you hit is, okay, I want a website like more than 5 pages, and doing purely static sucks because if I want to update the nav, I have to do that on 5 pages. So that's where static site generators come in and make just that repetition a lot easier. Now I can have my nav in one file, manage it in one place. So now I can build 10, 100 page websites with a static paradigm.
Yeah.
And I can build blogs and opens up a lot of opportunities like that. But then you hit a few limits with that as well, where one is build time, particularly with Jekyll, which was the most popular SSG at the time, where now if I want to build a 1,000 page website, that might take a minute to build, which if every time you, as a developer, you make an update and you have to wait a minute for the build, that's not a good workflow.
Yeah.
So static site generators like Hugo address that, built in Go, a lot faster build time, which again, like extends that limit. But now you're at, you know, when you get to hundreds of thousands of pages, you're hitting that sort of limit. So that's kind of one path of limitation, is just the size of the sites. The other is a static website. Well, Jamstack brought in these ideas of using APIs and JavaScript to bring in dynamic elements. And that works great, but you're doing that on the client side. So let's say you have an authenticated state in your nav bar and you show a profile image. You can't just show that on page request. You have to show a blank state, do an AJAX request to an API, get the all state, then bring it in. And just showing a lot of spinners in general. So that's where serverless functions come in to solve that limit, which Netlify really pioneered and I think made popular in this paradigm, where now the pages that are static can be static. The pages that need that dynamic functionality, you can just use a serverless function to render that page, either the whole page or have an API that will return dynamic content. So that pushes us out further. And now you can build whole applications with that paradigm.
Yeah, like the introduction of serverless, and like serverless is like now it's, again, this kind of feels like the standard, like use serverless if you're going to build something that that needs some compute or maybe some background jobs. Because like one of the examples that when I was at Netlify was like caching cookies. So like, hey, someone wants dark mode. Now it's trivial because now the Mac lets you know they want dark mode by default and stuff like that. But like it'll let your browser know that you're a dark mode person. So next time you come back, dark mode is always going to be the default when you come on. You store that in a serverless function. It caches that. It's stored in the user table or whatever it is. But you don't need to have a running server that basically say, oh yeah, Mike's back. Dark mode for him, or light mode, or whatever mode it is. But there are like so many other these, like I normally would like go pass a cookie back and forth to the server so that way the client would know exactly what was expectations. And I remember I built this app. And this was like as serverless was like getting, okay, there's good use cases. AWS Lambda was kind of the standard when it came to serverless functions. It was literally the standard because it was the first one that had mass adoption. And I built this app to tell me when there's a baseball game, and I called it Hustlin'. And the reason for that is like I had to get on a BART and then another train, the Muni, to get out to Netlify's office. So if there was like a Giants game, like
I see,
like it would slow down my entire commute. I spend like an extra hour, and now the Chase Stadium is like right there in between as well. So you got baseball and basketball at the same time.
You need multiple sports added to the set.
Yeah. So basically, it would just send me a text in the morning. So I had an app that basically you log in, is there baseball today.com, which I don't have anymore. And it would just tell me if there's baseball, yes or no. And then I did more of that. So then I'm like, oh, send me a text message through a serverless function in Twilio. And then I started doing all these extra things to like add serverless to a site to then check. Like as soon as you hit the client, it's already pinging the serverless function. I don't rebuild the site at all. It's just displaying whatever it's coming back from the serverless function. And it was like beautiful.
Yeah.
Now we see a lot of projects. And you mentioned like the multiple pages. Like I remember distinctly like Gatsby being like, they solved that problem a bit for like large agencies and enterprises that need multiple pages. Gatsby's came and went during this like old Jamstack.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's still around. Like you definitely still ship stuff with Gatsby. But what I'm getting at is there were always like this nice little solution for the next problem, the next problem, the next problem. And Jamstack became like this larger architecture. Do you think that Jamstack, is it benefiting that there's like now we have multiple choice to do almost anything on the Jamstack? Or do you feel like there is a paved path of you to solve problems?
Yeah, I'm kind of split between those. Like I think that evolution of new technology is necessary and really cool. Like serverless functions, as you say, have opened up so many opportunities. Like you probably wouldn't have built that service, or it'd be a much higher bar to build it if you had to spin up a DigitalOcean server and like manage it, make sure it was always online and have like a node script running. So the fact that you can just do that with the serverless function, yeah, it just lowers the bar to everything. But it's also a slippery slope where if the paradigm started as very clear of pre-rendering and decoupling, and then you add a little bit of dynamic functionality to open up some of these use cases. Pretty soon, we're in a world now where there's a lot of server-side rendering, which is also a good approach for particular problems. But you just expand the term so wide that it doesn't really mean anything anymore. It's everything from static to dynamic, which I don't really know what's not encompassed with that anymore. So I think for it to have meaning, it needs to be tighter. And it's not to say that other technology isn't good. It's just to talk about the trade-offs that you're making at each stage and to have the word actually mean something.
Yeah, so like we're now, like it's 2024 now. The serverless function, I think actually just recently came into, I guess, conversation, because now we've seen a couple of tweets like Vercel and both Netlify have had these like 100K bills, people are not putting on Hacker News. So what the promise is that if you get on Hacker News, your site will not go down. And that is true. But at what cost? And I think the cost that we're seeing now is like, if you have a bunch of compute and serverless functions, like your project's architected in a way that it's going to use some compute. We're now seeing like a string of tweets of folks like complaining about their bill being astronomical when the expectation was like, hey, I could just use Netlify. And it's like, it works, or I could use Vercel and it works. So do you see there's like now another evolution at play today, like that we're seeing unfold?
I think so. That case is interesting. The Netlify one was, I think, a 3 megabyte MP3 file.
Yeah.
That either got DDoSed or just downloaded a lot, which, I mean, it's a static file, right? So that's just a bandwidth cost.
Yeah.
And I think the problem there is what a lot of people are afraid of is I go on this free plan and I'm expecting to pay between zero and like $10 a month. And then suddenly I end up with $100,000 bill and I'm bankrupt. Like that's a scary thought to be on. But I think just bringing it back to your question of are we seeing a shift? I mean, any technology is a cycle and a pendulum. And if we go back one generation, we start in the 90s with static websites. We go through the same sort of things. It's like, okay, I can only have like a small website and managing like the nav across them sucks. So we're going to run a dynamic script that just has the nav live in one place and insert it dynamically onto the page. And then you go a step further and it's like, well, it's only web developers building for the web. What if we could have non-technical people editing for the web? And then you end up with WordPress and the whole ecosystem of WordPress, complexity, and you kind of lost that initial simplicity. So that's what Jamstack was. And now we've gone through the same thing of like solving problems and edge cases. And now it's complex.
Yeah.
There's a lot of moving pieces that all need to fit together and work together. And you don't know exactly, you're not guaranteed what's going to render. You have dynamic rendering.
Yeah.
So I think, and I think what we're seeing is a lot of conversations about simplicity and like yearning for those earlier days of just static for a lot of use cases.
Yeah, and I know I was on your podcast earlier. So you've been running this this series, like The Future of Jamstack. And I proposed the idea, and I'm curious if you put any more thought on this, because we mentioned WordPress a few times. Like Jamstack, we saw innovation, we saw the progression of like how we're building on the web, and now it's like mainstream. But does that mean that we need now, and Jamstack needs a WordPress? So then now we have the one, like the paved path, like decision tree. Okay, I know I want this architecture. What's the thing I can install to get that as fast? Or what's the thing I can purchase to get that the fastest?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the obvious candidate there is Next.js. It's dominating the space. And it is a tool that can do everything. I think a lot of technology is bundling and unbundling.
Yeah.
And I think Next.js is the bundle where you have a tool that can do anything from a simple portfolio website to powering an entire application, a software as a service business. And that's great because now all your developers just need to know this one tool and they can work on any part of, from the marketing site to an application. But a specialized tool for a particular use case is always going to be better at that use case.
Yeah.
I really believe in going to like browser standards. And I think HTML and CSS is just so elegant. I find it hard to beat that for, unless you need to go outside it for an application. I find it hard to beat that for simplicity and just the elegance of building simple websites. So it really depends on what you're trying to do. But I think there is a space where we really focus and get back to just HTML and CSS. That's the fundamental of the web from day one.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not CSS, but pretty soon after day one.
Yeah, and we see, Brian LaRue is working on this thing at Begin, which is like, taking a step back to building websites. We got Quick as well, which is focused on performance. And really, we have all these different paradigms that are kind of changing how we're approaching even building React apps. Like, for example, SolidJS completely breaks the paradigm on how folks are thinking about like their performance and their component rendering and their first time to paint. But like, we have a few other options when it comes to like Next alternatives. And I'm curious if like, does the community jump from Next to something else? Or have we all solidified on Next? And Next will just become the stronger base. And for anybody that wants to do like more of an indie or up-and-coming thing, like, yeah, we could always go spin up some JavaScript and HTML and then sprinkle in a little bit of like framework juice in there. It's like not a definitive answer. It's just more of me just like waxing poetic of like, we're in interesting times. And I think we could still build sites. We could still deploy them. We could still get stuff to our end users and customers. But the future of the Jamstack, which I guess I'll ask you this question, like you've been talking to a lot of folks in the space. Like, what's a TLDR? I like the thought process on a lot of these innovators and the folks that built a lot of these tools for us.
I feel like this movement's, we're like the paramedics and we've just got the defibrillator on Jamstack. We've just done the, and we're seeing if there's life there. And there is, like, there are people who are really interested in Jamstack and want it to exist. What the movement is about is trying to figure out exactly what that is and what that circle and core values are. We just had a panel discussing these ideas and we centered around this idea of portability. So I'm not tied to a particular hosting provider and I can basically deploy my website on any hosting provider of the web and immutability. So I should just be able to deploy my site and 10, 20 years later, it just exists. I don't need to make sure I'm at the latest version or fix any security vulnerabilities. And there's nothing dynamic there that can get hacked. It's just files on a web server. So something around those two ideas. We don't have the semantics around it yet. It's still pretty early, but I feel like that's where it's heading at the moment.
Excellent. Well, Mike, I do want to transition us to picks, but like, how could folks find out the content that you've been doing, particularly like with this podcast?
Yes. So you can go to thefutureofjamstack.org and we've got highlight clips of all the conversations we've been having as part of the project. And there's a survey there if you're interested in being involved that you can fill out.
Cool.
So if you're interested in Jamstack, yeah, excited to have you join.
Yeah. And are you all going to publish the results of the survey or are you just sort of like collecting thoughts and trying to figure out what next steps are?
Both.
Yeah.
So like we're feeding it into a lot of the conversations and panels and back and forth. But the whole idea is this is a community-led movement and we're doing everything, all the conversations and decisions and everything, doing in public and doing as a community.
Excellent. Sounds good. So let's transition to the picks. So these are things that we're jamming on, things that keep us going. Could be music, food, technology related, all of the above is on the table. And speaking of table, I'll go first. I just spent a day in Portland, got back yesterday, last night, and we did a series called The Pizza Bite. So we'll have a couple of new Pizza Bite episodes where we sit inside of a pizza restaurant and talk to open source luminaries, developer influencers, YouTube stars, whatever. But yeah, we talked to these folks just about questions and stuff that they have expertise in. And just recently had a conversation with True from Twitch and TikTok. But we actually had the pizza at Ranch Pizza in Portland. And I'm not very familiar with like all the neighborhoods in Portland, but it's there and you can Google it. And so Ranch PDX does a Detroit style pizza, which if anybody who's listened to this podcast, they know Detroit style pizza is definitely my favorite by far. And their whole gimmick is they provide ranch with pizza. And I've actually never been a ranch and pizza person. It just always disgusted me. Like there's already tomato sauce, like, or you have a white pizza. So why are you putting ranch on it? But this ranch was good. Like it was amazing. So I could definitely see like dipping carrots in there and like, or having a salad with it. But you know, we're there, we got to do the show. So I'm eating ranch for pizza. And by the end of it, I've eaten three slices. And it's like, it's a 15 minute podcast and I've had three slices and I've ate all my ranch. So I think I might've turned a corner. Maybe like, this is an age thing, but yeah, I'm down to do ranch on pizza and definitely try it. Don't knock it.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I've never even considered ranch on pizza. So I'm going to try this place out.
Same. Yeah, I'm here to convert you to a new lifestyle choice. I think there's a quality of ranch situation. Like you can't just put like Kraft ranch on there or something like that. You gotta get some homemade stuff, put it on there, and it kind of elevates the pizza. Cool, Mike. Do you have any picks for us?
Yeah, I'm gonna go on the pizza theme, and I'm gonna go cheese board pizza in Berkeley. So I've only been there once, and it was pre-pandemic as well. It's probably like 2018. But I talk about it all the time. They serve one vegetarian pizza a day. That's all you can get. You can just get pizza and it will be whatever it is that day. So it's a pretty cool ordering experience. There'll be a big line, but it's not like, oh, I want extra cheese and Hawaiian or whatever. It's just like, I want one pizza. And they'll just hand it to you immediately. It's already made. And the cool things on top of that is, I think you get the pizza and then there's two extra slices in the box. And then there's a dipping sauce as well. They're just over-delivering on expectations. So yeah, but I went there once and I talk about it all the time. I need to go back.
Yeah, it's... So I've got a history of the cheese board and that style of pizza. For those who are in the Bay Area, you know, there's like that style of like giving like cheese on bread. Actually, cheese board is a cheese shop in a bakery. And the reason for that is, and the reason like Arizmendi, there's a bunch of other like bakeries that do this. It's because tax reasons, bakeries are taxed lower than pizza shops. So if you want to like not be taxed like crazy to have a pizza shop, you make a bakery, you sell bread and cookies, and then you sell pizza.
Pizza on the side.
Yeah. So it's an easy way to like make sure dough doesn't go bad. And like you could also throw cheese on it because the cheese board, cheese shop and bakery. But I knew a guy who owned a company called Sliver. So he worked at Cheese Board he like had a sort of like troubled youth program. So he worked like sweeping floors and eventually like learned how to make pizzas. And then he started this company called Sliver, which is like literally the cheese board, but if it was like a full on chain. He ended up selling it a couple years ago, like right before the pandemic. Great story. I don't know if it's out there in public, but I happen to know the guy. And I'm a big fan of that style of pizza and the dipping sauce. And like, it's unreal how good it is. Like, it shouldn't be that good, but it's amazing.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I got all the pizza knowledge. So like, we'll talk offline about this. But Mike, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and chatting with me. I've been successfully educated about the future of the Jamstack. Folks, check out your show, Mike, Future of the Jamstack, and keep spreading the jam.
That's all we have time for today. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, or if you'd like to suggest a topic, find us on Twitter, at Jamstack Radio. This show is brought to you by Heavybit, the leading investor in developer-first startups. To learn more about Heavybit, visit heavybit.com.